I will say at the outset, the topic of this meeting, you know, I've spent most of my life trying to avoid couplings to the reservoir. in doing so, we learn a lot about that reservoir. And in fact, in the system I'll talk about, trapped atomic ions. Below the table. Okay, what number is this? Number four? No. Okay. Great. So in the experimental system, I'll talk about trapped atomic ions. I think it's widely acknowledged to be one of the most clean systems, quantum systems you can deal with, because of course the individual spins, I'll call them qubits or spins, they're all the same atom, same isotope, and in fact the same type of levels we use to define the qubits are used for the best atomic clocks in the world. So they're perfectly replicable. So you can think about scaling to really big systems. But of course, when you make a quantum system big, you know, you can't ignore the bath. I mean, at some point, you're going to have to pay attention to it. So everything I'll tell you here is related to how we want to build, obviously, big quantum information devices, quantum computers, and so forth. However, over the last many years, there's been great interest in the physics community of using these same techniques to do quantum simulations, and many folks think this will be really the first application of quantum computers in any case. So this is work from my group at the University of Maryland, let's just dig right in. Very, very quickly, the atomic systems, with not too much detail here. As I said, we store an effective spin 1/2 particle in these two magnetically insensitive states, sometimes called clock states. They are magnetically sensitive because we do have a weak magnetic field on. There's a small quadratic Zeeman shift, but coherence times of many seconds is really easy to do. If you really need many hours, we can do that as well. And this will kind of introduce the theme of all of what we work on, and that is all of our errors. Most of our errors, almost all of our errors, are not fundamentally limited by quantum decoherence, but they're control errors. And I'll comment on that throughout. Maybe we can ask questions, and you can pose some questions later on what the connection is. So there's our quantum bit or spin, and we can measure the state with very high accuracy by using a standard atomic physics technique of state-dependent fluorescence. One state can support a cycling transition. And the other state's largely dark. And so we can discriminate even in a single shot between bright and dark and therefore have detection fidelities that are well in excess of 99%. It's just how much fidelity do you need for your measurement? Depends on how big the system is. If you only have 10 qubits, you probably don't need more than 99%. Once again, these are errors that we understand and we can make better. I think the record's probably from Innsbruck. Reiner Blott's group, they have an optical qubit, 99.99 something, I believe, a detection fidelity per spin. Now, to do the more interesting manipulation with laser, the coherent one, I won't get into details on the technology here, except it's pretty simple technology. It's just a laser. It's a pulse laser. It's made for lithography, 355, fixed wavelength, only one adjustment. It's the key. Turn it on. And that's actually a big deal if you're building something that you don't want to think about the controls and you want it very quiet. It's a very well-engineered laser. And it's optimally matched to the ytterbium ion, and that's pretty much why we use ytterbium. It produces a frequency comb, and without getting into too much details, the qubit has a frequency splitting of 12.6 gigahertz. The bandwidth of this comb is about 100 gigahertz. The spacing of the combs is about 100 megahertz. There's a lot of rates for you there. But every comb tooth and its, I guess, like 126th neighbor contributes coherently to this process. And it's a mode-locked laser, so transform limited pulses. We get to use all the power and drive a coherent transition. And so here's a very simple experiment with a single qubit showing both coherence and near-perfect measurement. This is a Rabi flopping experiment. We prepare I'm going back and forth, down and up, 0 and 1. We prepare in the state 0. We drive, we illuminate this ion, this spin, with light for a certain amount of time. Then we stop, And we measure the qubit, bright or dark. And of course, it can only be bright or dark in a single shot. So this is what the real data looks like. So this is Robbie flopping with perfect, near perfect measurement. Of course, the usual Robbie flopping that you see would be if you averaged over many, many runs. And it's actually not perfect. It's pretty good. This is raw data here. And if you take many, you know, dozens of these curves, you'll see a little bit of a tapering. That's entirely due to intensity noise. It's not interesting. It's not fundamental decoherence. The spin decohering by itself is, I don't know, maybe a million of these or something. Okay, so it's not, we're not going to be limited by that. Okay, so now I want to dive in, show how we make correlated states, entangled states, and not just for quantum computing, the same physics we can generate interesting spin models to do quantum simulations of magnetism, and I'll introduce the concept of what the bath means in that system and how to interpret these simulations. So a very simple view of how you entangle ions, following early ideas a long time ago by Serac and Zoller and refined by others, involves a spin-dependent force, or optical tweezers that are, if you want to address individual spins here, if we want to entangle, say, these two, the atomic selection rules allow us to have this force be either up or down, depending on the state of each spin. So if your atom is in a superposition of up and down, the atom, of course, forms an effective electric dipole, if you want to think of it that way. And so there will be a dipole-dipole interaction between these two. You can also think of this in terms of just these two ions. If they're both spin up, their Coulomb interaction is the same as spin down. But if they're down up or up down, then they're slightly further apart, and they have a defect in energy that goes like 1/r³. And if you were trying to build a quantum gate to do an entanglement experiment here to entangle these two, you're at the truth table of those two spins, and you see the mixed ones feel this phase shift. And the phase shift is sort of proportional to the amount of time that they were separated, and the distance where they were, the distance they moved, which is a few nanometers typically. And when you set that to pi over 2, it's equivalent to a controlled knot gate. It'll make full entangled states. And this physics is correct if the pulse is really fast. If you do it super fast and then you bring them back before any normal modes get excited, okay? So in one limit, this is actually accurate, but in fact, we don't, in almost none of our research, do we apply these beams in the ultra-fast regime. They're slow, and imagine a bunch of pendulums connected by springs, and we're wiggling them slowly compared to their, you know, resonant frequency. So it's sort of a mess, right? You have to conclude the normal modes of all these phonons, and that's one interesting feature of this system, the phonon modes. If you leave the spins entangled with the phonon modes and you're only considering the states of the spins, that's an effective decoherence bath. So there are many ways out to not have to couple to those phonons. One is to go fast, as I said before. Another is to pre-calculate your laser pulse just so that the motion that you excite, it's all coherent here. There's no decoherence here. But if you excite these atoms in just the right way and you pre-calculate laser pulses, and if you have n ions here, there are n choose two separate programs you have to calculate beforehand, you can have the motion disentangle at the end of the operation. And so even though the motion is entangled during the gate, if you synchronize this for a certain time, you can disentangle it. But there's another regime as well, and that is we can dispersively couple to the motion. That is, we can have this force very far detuned from any phonon resonances. And in that sense, it's a very good approximation that the phonons are just never coupled. And that's going to be where we have a pure spin model. You don't have to worry about the motion. So there's another complication here in that, in fact, the typical way we run this gate, again, as first proposed by Molnar and Sorensen, Solano and Milburn, is we do it in the X basis instead of the Z basis. And again, I won't get into the details there, but it's the same physics, really. And when you do that, this is what we call our native gate in ion traps these days. That's it. If you have an ion trap system, this is your native gate. It's an icing interaction in the X direction. Okay? And so there's the evolution operator. And the times and fidelities, depending on your system, It's important to note that the error budget in these fidelities is pretty well understood. There's nothing fundamental there. We don't have natural correlated noise or anything. And the gate times are in the microsecond range. Now, here's the dispersive regime where we detune from these normal modes. And if I draw a spectrum in frequency of the beat note of our laser beam, so this would be 12 gigahertz here, there's a response at 12 gigahertz. You basically undergo spin flips, as I showed. We call that the carrier, and there's the Hamiltonian of the carrier. But similar to what Mehta just spoke about in the context of essentially NMR, we can realize phonon sidebands, upper and lower sidebands. But these sidebands, we know where they are. These frequencies, they can be calculated. It's a classical calculation. It's a linear Coulomb spin chain. And there are the Hamiltonians, the upper sideband, sometimes called the anti-Janes-Cummings model, and the lower sideband, the Janes-Cummings model. And this is assuming the so-called Lamb-Dickey regime, where this force, because it's generated by a beat note of laser beams, the ions have to be localized to well less than a wavelength, so that you can linearize the force, and you get these couplings. So a little bit of math here, it's actually not so bad. Within the Lamb-Dickey limit and the usual rotating wave approximation, meaning that you can couple to the sidebands without worrying about coupling to this carrier, as long as you drive it slowly enough, we have a spin-dependent force. This thing in brackets is the X operator of the ith ion, expressed in terms of normal mode, raising and lowering operators, A and A dagger. And we have a detuned force here. So there's an oscillating term in front of A and A dagger here. We're detuned from all these normal modes. We're not coupling directly. And so this is a harmonic Hamiltonian. Oh, I should define these terms. Well, I'm not going to bother. You can just read. It's the scale of the force is set by the recoil frequency, having to do with the wavelength and the mass of the ions. So pretty straightforward here. Now, this Hamiltonian is interesting because it doesn't commute with itself at different times, because A and A dagger, of course, for a given mode don't commute. But it's a harmonic Hamiltonian, and we can form an effective Hamiltonian. You can think of the Magnus expansion if you want, but we can exactly calculate the effective Hamiltonian, and it has to do with the commutator between H at one time and then another time you integrate over it and so forth. And when you get over all the math, this is also called adiabatic elimination of the phonons. We're detuned from them, so we can sort of eliminate them. That is an approximation, and as long as you're detuning is more than the sideband Rabi frequency, it's a good approximation. You end up with a pure spin Hamiltonian here, the icing model. Not a surprise, I just motivated it with the individual pairwise quantum operation. Here, it's a global icing interaction between all spins. And when you can see this Lorentzian, when you drive a harmonic oscillator off resonance, you get a Lorentzian response, and there it is. The Bs are the normal mode matrix elements between I and I and mode M, and you have to sum over all the modes with their individual detunings, this Lorentzian, and this is the scale of the icing coupling. Now, what's interesting about this, it's trivial to add a transverse field. This is just Rabi flopping on the carrier, and you'll notice the carrier tone appeared. So if we have three frequencies on this laser beat note, we have a transverse field icing model. Now, if we study this transverse icing model, the icing coupling, again, I wrote this equation before, it's a very good approximation that this follows a power law, an inverse power law. And what's cool is that you can control the power of that power law simply by controlling the detuning. So as you move, as you're close to only the center mass mode, alpha is zero, it's an all-on-all coupling, but if you go really far, It's sort of like the ultrafast limit, where you populated the phonon modes, but only for a tiny period of time. So you get a dipole-dipole interaction. Alpha is equal to 3. And so this is just theory here, numerical simulations of a Coulomb chain. It's a classical computation, calculating this exactly based on the normal mode eigenvectors. And as we vary the detuning compared to the bandwidth of these modes, you see that the power law approximation is not too bad. This is a straight line on a log-log plot, and then it asymptotes to 3 when you get really far away. I'll also refer you to John Bollinger's talk on Friday. He'll talk more about this model as applied to even bigger crystals in 2 dimensions in a Penning trap. A lot of the physics, though, will carry over. So with that background, we have this transverse field icing model, which is very powerful because, of course, that's the maybe you could argue it's the simplest model that admits a quantum phase transition, so we can start to talk about things, we can start to talk about thermalization, we can talk about phase transitions and phases. And in the title of my talk, I said with a finite number of atoms. That's a little weird to talk about a phase or even the concept of a thermodynamic limit with finite size systems. So there's some questions here, and maybe this will be fodder for discussion after lunch. Is this really an open quantum system? Well, I'd like to think it's not, that we're only limited by the engineering of our controllers, and we can sort of push off the interaction with the reservoir as cleanly as we want. The qubit itself, when you leave it alone, it's essentially infinitely lived, and also it has infinite T2. And even if there is a fluctuating magnetic field, it's going to be long wavelength, and so all the spins are going to feel the same thing. So it's only the relative phase that matters if you want to do some kind of quantum control experiment. So we can really make T2 infinitely long compared to any time scale we care about. So in a sense, it's not really an open quantum system. But of course, that everything up here is somewhat of an approximation, particularly these phonons I spoke about. To make this Ising model, we had to couple the phonons. It's sort of like going to hell and back. I mean, you just have to make sure you survive the trip. And there are ways to do that, and we understand we can bound the errors due to the induced decoherence from coupling these phonon modes. And it comes from two sources. The phonon modes themselves are sort of noisy. You can imagine a chain of a crystal of atoms that are in superpositions of positions. They're charges, and they're in superpositions of positions. If there's a noisy electric field around, that's going to cause decoherence of the phonon system, and it'll be mapped back to the spin. And the other way you can lose information is if you didn't perfectly disentangle the phonons from the spin. Even if the phonons were perfect and they were a closed system themselves and perfectly clean, even at zero temperature, if you left any information in the phonons and you trace over that degree of freedom, your spins effectively have lost coherence. So, of course, it's an open system. We're using this big harmonic oscillator, these normal modes, to make the interaction. So there is some opening there. One thing I didn't talk about is spontaneous scattering. One of my early slides, this laser that drives the operation, it's actually far detuned from any resonances, but not infinitely far. And so the scale of that, we never worry about that. It's 10 to the minus 5 or something. So if you pick the appropriate atomic system, the spontaneous scatter can be 10 to the minus 5 of the coherent Rabi frequency. So you don't really have to worry about it. But at some point, you will. If you have to do a million operations, you're going to have to worry about it. Again, the phonon one's kind of interesting because I think it can be engineered. By using these laser pulses, we can shape and tailor the spin decoherence in interesting ways. I see John Simon over there. We have Mirion, exactly this topic, that aims to create even something like a phononic band gap in a crystal of ions that might confine the phonons to a small section of a huge chain. That's a little out there, but kind of cool. And then, of course, this is maybe what I want to talk more about, and that is, even if you forget the phonons, we have these spins, and we've made entanglements throughout the system. Well, if you consider a subset of that system, one way to consider decoherence is that if they're entangled with the rest, and you trace over J, system I becomes a mixed state. That's true decoherence. It's almost by definition. You're considering a smaller system. So there's lots of interest on connecting a real closed system. You know, I plus J is closed. But connecting the concept of thermalization to a closed system, of course, it's the subsystem that's not essentially closed anymore, because the reservoir then is itself a closed system. So there's interesting models of decoherence in this context, and maybe I'll talk a little bit about that. Okay, so what's next? All right, so the first thing you might consider to do with this all-on-all Ising model is to try to maybe adiabatically prepare interesting ground states. So this is a long-range Ising model. If J is positive, then this is an antiferromagnetic long-range Ising model, so there's frustration. Gaps are going to be small, and there's going to be lots of entanglement in the low energy states. So the idea behind an adiabatic manipulation here would be to prepare the spins, say, polarize along Y, and put on a large magnetic field along Y, does nothing. The spins are already along or anti-aligned with B, I guess. And then if you adiabatically lower B and or raise J like this in time, we start with B over J big, end up with B over J zero or small, then if the process was indeed adiabatic, entropy is conserved, you're always in the ground state the whole way, you end up in the ground state of this guy, which is highly entangled. Of course, the trick there is that if it's an interesting ground state and it's highly entangled, it's probably highly frustrated, and the gaps are going to get really small, and there's an exponential in here. You have to go infinitely slow to do that. So that's sort of the pitfall of this approach. But let's just look at a few. These are old experiments. They're just for illustrative purposes. So this is a ferromagnetic interaction where it tells you a little bit about the closedness of this system. We made an effective ferromagnetic interaction not by changing the sign of J, but by initially polarizing the spins to be in the highest excited state along the field, along the Y field. And again, adiabatically, you can follow the highest excited state in this countable closed system. And it's effectively like reversing the sign of the Hamiltonian. We started in the highest energy state of an AFM Hamiltonian. That's sort of like starting in the ground state of a ferromagnetic Hamiltonian. And this is the evolution of the sweep, the magnitude magnetization, because again, we should never see any magnetization because there's a Z2 symmetry here, up and down. So even if we make a ferromagnetic ground state all up, we're also making all down. We're making a superposition of those probably, so there's no magnetization of that. So by taking the magnitude, you get rid of that problem. And you can see that indeed the magnetization sort of, this is a little hard to see on this plot, it starts out with no magnetization. They start along Y and then they end up being ordered along the X direction. And this axis is the number of spins. As we add more spins, this crossover is what I want to focus on. It gets sharper and sharper, a little bit anyway. I mean, 9 is really not the thermodynamic limit, I suppose. But if you were to take this to 9 billion, I suppose that would be a step function. And it's a ferromagnetic interaction, so the gap is always big. So that's sort of an easy one. But it's also a trivial state. It's not very entangled. All up plus all down, you know, you can write down that state. So it's more interesting to look at AFM cases. And again, this is sort of old data. This is exactly 10 spins. This calibration on our camera, all up and all down. Now the thing about AFM data is that it's spatially dependent. The Neil order, of course, has a up-down structure. So you need to look at position-dependent fluorescence of all the spins. So in this experiment, we had a long-range icing interaction with these 10 spins. We took 2,600 runs of some adiabatic sweep, and out of 2,600 times, about 440 times, we saw one of two of the ground states we expected. That's 17% of the entire configuration space. So what happened to all the rest of it? Well, it turns out we weren't slow enough. We were making excited states. And so 2%, 8% of the time, we made one of these states that has domain. These have domain walls near the middle of the chain, because the chain is actually not uniformly spaced. It's left to right symmetric, but the ions on the ends are a little further apart. So the walls like to happen. The lowest energy excitations happen. The walls happen closer to the middle. And then about 4% of the time, we saw one of these states where the domain walls move out. Okay, and there's another 1,010 states that we could plot. We can measure the probability of all of them, actually, by doing lots of runs. The initial paramagnetic state, there's a uniform distribution along X, because we have up plus down to the 10th power. So you have all 1024 states. And then after the ramp, we see the two Neil order states pop up with, as I said before, about 17% total. And then we have all this hair, all this other stuff. Looks like noise. It's not noise. Our ramp was too fast, apparently. It wasn't adiabatic. We're actually making a wave packet, if you want, of these spins. And if you look at the distribution of these of this hair here, it's not exactly exponential. By selection rules, there are some states that are totally absent here. But if you look at the cumulative, so what I'm plotting here is the probability of getting this. It's the same data as this, only it's ordered not by binary index, but by energy. With 10 spins, we can calculate all of them. We can rank which ones are higher energy. And the higher energy states aren't very well populated. So it does sort of go down. When you integrate this this distribution, you see something like an exponential, you know, 1 minus exponential curve. And so what first struck me about this data is sort of looks like a temperature, right? Why is it exponential? I guess that's a deep question. And if it is exponential, is there an effective Boltzmann factor there? And what does that temperature mean? So these are interesting questions, I think, within closed systems about what does it mean to have a thermalizing process. And these two curves slightly differ in their time constant based on the range of the interaction. This gives the gaps, the energy gaps change as well. Okay, so that was pretty early data, and when we increase the number of spins, well, from 10 to 14, these percentages go down. Instead of 17%, it's like 3%. There's a lot more configurations, the gaps are getting smaller, so maybe not unexpected. So this topic of thermalization is an interesting one, and when we think of systems, quantum systems, and their thermalization, especially in the context of a closed system, there are a few ways that you can effectively have the systems not thermalize. One would be if the system's integrable. But our transverse Ising model is not integrable, surely not. It's a long range, one over power law with distance, and we have a transverse field that doesn't commute with the Ising. So this is not integrable, so we wouldn't expect the system to not thermalize. You'd expect it to sort of wander around. But there are a few concepts that can violate this idea of thermalization. One is so-called pre-thermalization. Another one is many-body localization. And these are both kind of interesting topics in quantum thermodynamics these days. And yeah, I probably don't have time to talk about too much of. I wanted to talk a little bit about MBL because to get many-body localization, we have to add disorder. And it's a little bit distasteful. We have this beautiful quantum system. We're adding disorder to the chain. But when you do that, you can actually stabilize the dynamics of the system, which could be, I'm not sure it's going to be useful for trapped ions, but it could be useful for, say, an ensemble of NV diamond and learning how to manipulate your disorder or what types of disorder will work for you to stop dynamics and even maybe control decoherence. All right, I'm a little bit on thin ice on that topic. But pre-thermalization is sort of an interesting phenomenon that happens when you have a, say, exactly one pair of energy levels that have a little real tiny gap. And so this is an example of I think there's 20 or 22 spins here. And here we didn't apply an Ising model. We applied an XY model. I won't get into the details how, but it's very similar to the Ising experiment I motivated earlier. The interesting thing about this Hamiltonian is it preserves the total spin of the system. So this is sometimes a flip-flop Hamiltonian if you want. So if we prepare a highly excited state, that is, we excite the first spin up and all the others are down, and we let this evolve, it will conserve the number of excitations in the chain always. And after a long time, long meaning, well, T is 36 over J, and it's a long-range coupling, remember this. So lots of dynamics have happened. This is an average image of about 1,000 runs. That single excitation has been everywhere. But it hasn't moved very far. You might expect for JT of 36 that this is nearest neighbor J times T is 36. It would have maybe gone to the middle. But if you look at the dynamics, and again, pay attention to the raw data here, the blue data, it looks like it's not really going to the middle, the center of the chain, the excitation. It's sort of saturating. And a good indictment of this data is that you didn't wait long enough. Well, we couldn't wait long enough because the noise on our laser effectively makes the data wash out. It's not fundamental decoherence, it's control errors, once again. And one way to think about this so-called pre-thermalization type dynamics is that when you, when you have very long range interactions, small inverse exponent, there's an energy gap that's anomalously small compared to all the others, and it just takes a long time for the true thermalization to happen. Now, what should happen theoretically is this will eventually creep up to zero, but it will take so long we can't observe that, unfortunately. So pre-thermalization, again, I don't kind of have time to talk about MBL, but a similar experiment with MBL sort of quenched the, it prevented thermalization from happening in a very controlled way, and sorry, I don't have time to go through this. There's a host of other simulation techniques. One of them actually uses MBL in this ion system to form what's called a time crystal, which stabilizes the response of a driven system. It's a Floquet technique. And there were two articles in this issue, one with ions and one with NV diamond ensembles. And the data looks almost identical from the two systems, which is kind of neat. I mean, one had only a few numbers of ions, and the other had a huge collection of NV in an ensemble. And I only have time for this. Very quickly, with lots of qubits, we've observed something called a dynamical phase transition, our favorite Hamiltonian here. But in this case, it's a quench experiment where we prepare long X, we turn on this Hamiltonian, then we measure long X. Couldn't get simpler than that. So it all depends on what B and J are. If B is really big, then the spins will just precess along the Z direction. If J is really big compared to B, then nothing happens because they're already along the X direction. And so we sort of see a transition between, this is measuring the magnetization of all the spins, and we see a transition between, you know, not much happening and then precession along the magnetic field. If we look at two-body correlators, we see as a function of B over J sort of a dip with more and more spins, that dip gets more pronounced, but it's still not, in the infinite limit, this should be a divergence. It was only with lots and lots of ions we were able to observe an order parameter that's an n-body correlator, and it had to do with the largest domain size, and that did indeed find a kink here. And I guess I would argue that with 53 spins, we can't compute where that kink is going to be. Maybe somebody can, but it makes it a really hard problem because there are 2^53 configurations. So I guess I'm gonna step back, and I won't talk about scrambling, even though some may at this meeting. But I wanted to, I guess, open questions we'll talk about later. I'll put this up later. But some of them are going to be controversial and so forth. But it has to do with, and maybe I'll conclude on my earlier slide with the question of, is this a closed system? And I'll leave that up there and field any questions. Thank you.
All right, questions?
So I remember the slide where you were complaining about these defects forming. Can you instead count them and look into Keibel-Zurek physics?
Mm-hmm. What's interesting here is these exponents in the Keibel-Zurek description of the phase transition. It's clouded by the fact that the chain is inhomogeneous, number one, and it's a long-range interaction. So the X, I'm not sure, you know, maybe somebody else can answer this question. I'm not sure that you get the same universal exponents because dimensionality is not well defined here. It's an all-on-all, it's an all-coupled spin system with a power law interaction. So you could argue if alpha is bigger than 1, then it's sort of 1D. And if it's less than 1, then it's n-dimensional, I suppose. So there has been some work, maybe even from Innsbruck. Some people can probably point this out. Yeah.
There's a theory paper by my group, actually, that does all the Keibel-Zurek exponents for long-range easy models, so I can point you to that.
Oh, good.
Indeed, you can still see quite a bit of, you know, universal behavior according to TDMRG-type simulations.
Mm-hmm.
They have yet to be measured in experiments, so that remains an open experimental problem. And you can get to them at the lowest level from mean field extension of Jordan-Wigner, and then you can correct that with the full quantum many-body calculation with tensor networks. So,
as you change the range of the interaction, do you then sort of see a definition of dimensionality in the system?
You could think of it that way. You certainly see a modification away from the nearest neighbor predicted exponent, you know, 1/2. So,
cool.
And that has sort of reasonable directions for both ferro and antimagnetic cases and physical interpretation. So I'll pass that to you after.
Yeah, thanks.
Maybe I can comment further on this. I think in Lincoln's work, your alpha exponent is larger than 1. Yeah, because with collaborators, I have a work for the case where it's smaller than 1, and we find a real qualitative difference. So you do not, for the usual Keibel-Zurek quench across a critical point, you don't find Keibel-Zurek scaling, but only for scaling that either ends at the critical point or starts at the critical point, you get scaling behavior, but otherwise you have really like new different physics. And I mean, we have predicted this for the transverse field easing model, the long range case, mm-hmm. but it hasn't been studied experimentally yet. So maybe that's something interesting to look into.
Okay, well, thanks for that.
Hi, so I have a question regarding the pre-thermalization part. So do you have a theoretical accompanying study which says that the value to which you converge is the one due to the presence of approximate conservation laws? Or because we have work which showed that in the presence of openness, a new generalized Gibbs ensemble is reached in long time steady state, and I'm wondering whether what you see is really the the pre-thermal GGE or a steady state GGE.
Yeah, there's sort of two timescales here, and this pre-thermal timescale, it's a little bit artificial because it seems to stop evolving, and there is a timescale associated with that that would be, in a sense, the average gap in the spectrum. Maybe you can think of the dynamics following that, but there's this one pair of levels, this doublet in our system, that is almost degenerate, and that defines another time scale for the full thermalization. We can never observe our system long enough to see that, but it's predicted. I think it's maybe a few hundred to a few thousand times the amount of time that we have observed. I'm not sure I'm even answering your question, but
yeah, because like we predict that you will not thermalize because of the openness.
Oh.
And yeah, I'm just wondering. Yeah, maybe we can discuss more.
Is the system integral?
So even if you have you need just an approximately integrable model, and then openness will stabilize the GGE.
I see. Okay. Oh, maybe we should talk later about that. Sounds interesting.
Other questions?
So, Chris, I'll take the prompt from your slide there. Under yes, you have engineered phonon spin coupling plus phonon decoherence may be interesting. Do you want to tell us something about that? Or is it a secret?
No. The phonon decoherence part, so it's always there. And in fact, these chains in space are very small compared to their distance to any of the electrodes. So that means any electric field noise is going to be very long wavelength. That means it's going to couple primarily to just the center of mass modes of motion. The internal modes are largely immune from that. So the question is, if you want a very clean coupling here, you want to avoid the center mass mode, and so maybe you can engineer a spin phonon coupling by sacrificing qubits or spins to prevent that center mass mode from causing indirect decoherence of the spins. Maybe that's not even interesting. I don't know. What I was thinking more interesting was the idea of confining phonons. So if you want to scale this, it's always disappointingly small. There's data up to dozens of qubits. John will show data with hundreds. But if you wanted to scale to, say, 10,000 of these spins in some geometry, there's a question that there's a forest of modes. The Coulomb interaction is very long range. And you might want to have a confinement of the motional excitations to be in a small part of that chain. And you could think about parallelizing. It's sort of a modular approach to doing that kind of phonon engineering. So maybe if you had a chain of 1,000, every 50 spins, you have a couple of sacrificial spins that you drive in just such a way that prevents the phonons from extending, from becoming normal modes. I think that's kind of interesting. And again, I brought up the term phononic band gap, which is being used in some optomechanics experiments to isolate these membranes from coupling to their room temperature environment, just by drilling holes in the right way. So we're drilling holes in our chain in the right way to confine phonons. I think it's pretty interesting.
More questions?
So you were driving your magnetic field for your system. Is it possible to drive the interaction instead?
Yeah, good point. That was a technical point that we decided to modulate B instead of J. This is not a real magnetic field, by the way. It's also a laser beam that drives spin flips. It's a transverse field to the Z direction of our spins. The laser beams that produce this icing coupling, they're higher intensity, because it's a second order process. And so when we vary this J, there are systematic effects called AC Stark shifts that change a lot when we do that, and we're effectively adding a Z field along with that thing. It's just messy. But by doing it this way, it's a lower intensity beam, very low intensity beam. There's negligible AC Stark shifts from that. It's just very technical. But yeah, indeed, we can certainly modulate J. Maybe other atomic systems would be less sensitive to that effect. Is there a reason why we should do J instead of B? Yeah, let's hear it. Now we're getting somewhere.
No, I'm just connecting to what I talked about yesterday to make this thing chaotic and try to use it as a sensor, make a kicktop model out of it. That would be very interesting.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Maybe we can talk later about that. Sorry, I wasn't here yesterday.
Any more questions? Or everybody ready for lunch? All right. Do you have any?
I do, but let's.
Yep. Let's thank Chris and.